Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Shattered Rose by Joe Beverly, narrated by Charlie Olbers. 1. Northumbria, England, July 1100. The troop of armed men rode steadily along the rough wooded road, each heavy hoofful spraying mud over already muddy beasts. Travel-worn and weary, they pressed on as inexorably as a river heading for the sea. Motley patches scattered blowing cloaks, and wind whipped through ragged holes that had not been patched at all. Under dirt and mud, little could distinguish man from master, but three things set two men apart. They rode better horses, they wore chainmail beneath the cloaks, and while their men carried bow or spear, each of these two bore a well-used sword at his side and a shield on his saddle. The lighter built of the two men raised a hand and reined in. Without further word, the other eight swung down toward the nearby river to rest and water the horses. As they dismounted, it could be seen that some limped, and one man had only a stump where his right hand used to be. The leader's haggard face bore a puckered burn mark on the forehead, and a blade scar along the jaw, made obvious because the stubble did not grow well around it. These were men, just back from war, and the darkness of their skin suggested they had fought in lands far hotter than this, northern corner of England. In fact, faded and obscured by dirt, a red cross remained on some of the cloaks. These men had been upon the enterprise of God. They were crusaders. Perhaps they had seen the Jordan, where Christ was baptized, and Jerusalem, where he suffered and died. They had likely waded through the rivers of blood that flowed through the streets of the holy city when the Christian forces finally claimed it. The leader dismounted, stretched, then pushed back his chainmail coif to shake loose damp, shaggy brown hair. It was clear nature had never intended him to be a big man, but now he was fine down to muscle and sinew. His dark eyes sunk deep beneath dark brows. Gaelron of Hayward shivered under the chill of the North Sea breeze on his sweaty nape. But it was a pleasant chill, an English chill. He was in England, and before sunset, he would be home. After more than two long years, he would be home. The previous day, they'd landed at Stockton in a mizzling rain that had set Gaelron's companion, Raoul de Jure, shuddering and wondering that anyone could call such weather summer. Gaelron, however, had welcomed it. There'd been many times these past 2 years when he'd feared he would never feel damp again, never ride through an English morning mist, never touch ice or see the vibrant green growth fostered by the rainy English climate. He had thought he would die in the searing heat of Outremer. They could have spent the night in Stockton. In fact, they could have lingered there a 12-month and never paid for board or lodging, except with stories of their holy adventures. For Gaelron's haste to be home meant they were the first crusaders to be seen in the area. Gaelron, however, had stopped in the port just long enough to buy horses, then had pushed on, heading like a hart to water, home, to Jeanne, his beloved wife, and to his son, a son he had never seen, born 9 months after he left for Jerusalem. A son who was both reason for taking the cross and reason to regret it, and reason to stay even when the bloodshed sickened him. For Gaelron had gone on crusade to beg God for a child, and God in his love had been kind. Jeanne had called the child Gaelron, but said in her first letter after the birth that he would be called Gallet, at least while he was little. Gallet had surely been conceived on their last night together, after Gaelron had taken the cross and made his vow to free Jerusalem from the heathen or to die in the attempt. Gallat, his firstborn son, now 18 months old, and doubtless walking, but without any knowledge of his father. That was a bitter sacrifice, but necessary. Christ had never said that his yoke would be easy. It was only when John Redbeard, his sergeant, took Gaelren's restive mount to walk it, that he realized he'd been daydreaming, instead of taking proper care of the beast. It was part tiredness, for they'd ridden through most of the last night, but it was also the grip of his need to be home with his wife and child. He'd joined the crusade for one reason only, to break the curse of their childlessness, but he'd never dreamed that Christ's reward would be so prompt. That generosity, however, had bound Gaelren as if with iron chains. How could he flinch from the task of liberating the holy city, when God had granted his boon so quickly and so perfectly? Through all the hardship and disillusion, sickened by what he saw around him and longing to be home, Gaelren had held to his vow. Because of that miracle, a child for Jahan, he had fought on till the bitter triumphant end, till the forces of Christendom had entered Jerusalem. As always, that memory seized him, froze him with a vision of blood, rivers of blood, and the screaming mouths of men, women, and children. He shook his head. That was long past and over, and soon he would have his reward, his son in his arms, and his wife content at last. He wished he'd had more news, so he would have a better picture in his mind of the child. The last letter to reach him had been written when the babe was 3 months old. Jahan had recounted a screed of description and clever doings. But that chubby babe was gone now, and presumably smiling was no longer a matter of pride. The bald head Jahan had lamented would be covered with hair, dark like his own, or pale silky blonde like his mother's. Which? It seemed a father should know. That letter had arrived just as Gaelren was riding off to help liberate Bethlehem. And when he had knelt on the ground of Christ's birthplace, he had been guiltily aware that his joy at being there was largely because they were close to Jerusalem. Within days, they would see the walls of the holy city. With God's help, they would quickly take it, and Gaelren's vow would be satisfied. He could return home. From the moment of taking sail, all he had wanted was to be home. Gallat had Gaelren's brown eyes. That had been fixed at 3 months. With luck, he'd inherited his father's darker skin as well, or he'd never be able to take the cross. Jahan's delicate pallor would have blistered to a crisp in Outremer, as many northern complexions had. Gallat wouldn't be big unless he threw back to the grandparents. Jahan's father had been a tall man, and Gaelren's father was a great bear of a man, a fearsome warrior in his day. All his sons had taken after him, except Gaelren. A light build was a disadvantage in a fighting man, but training could compensate, as Gaelren had proved. Anyway, smaller men were often more agile, and big, fleshy men had perished more quickly in the heat and privation of the crusade than the sinewy ones. "You can't live on dreams, you know." Gaelren turned to see Raoul offering a mutton pie. "Eat. Your lovely wife won't welcome a scarecrow." Raoul was one of the big men, but hard with muscle, and seemingly able to survive anything, appetites and good humor intact. "She'll welcome me in any form," Gaelren said. But when he bit into the cold pie, he realized he was hungry, and he might need his strength. He hoped he would need his strength. Tonight. At the thought of the night and the bed and Jahan, a ripple of painful desire shot through him to land predictably in his cock and harden it. How close are we? Rao shot a long stream of wine into his mouth from a wineskin, then passed it over. Garen tilted the skin and drank, subduing his lust, as he had done 1,000 times before. Less than 10 leagues? With God's blessing, we should arrive before dark. Rao grinned. With your impatience, we'll push on even if darkness falls. Not that I blame you. If I'd taken a vow of fidelity and was within sniffing distance of my wife, nothing would stop me either. The very thought of you taking a vow of fidelity makes my head ache, my friend. Perhaps interest in carnal matters fades after time.
Does it?
Gaelren laughed.
No, I didn't think so.
So, let's press on. We don't want you to explode. He bellowed to the men to prepare the horses. Still smiling, Gaelren took time to finish the pie, grateful to have Rao by his side. His friend was by no means stupid, but he had an uncomplicated view of life. He fought fiercely when he had to, but then put it out of his head. Gaelren fought fiercely when he had to, but he agonized over each death, particularly over the deaths of innocents. In Jerusalem, even the children had fought and died. Again, he pushed such thoughts out of his head. They did no good. No good at all. Rao ate when he was hungry, drank when he was thirsty, and used women when he felt the need. He reminded Gaelren to eat and drink, and teased him about his celibacy. Everyone knows it's harmful for a man to store his seed, he had argued. Monks survive. God gives them a special blessing. Then I'd think God would give the same blessing to crusaders. But we're not pledged to celibacy. God knows it would weaken us. Are you saying I'm weak? Rao had laughed, for shorter and lighter, Gaelren could often beat him in armed combat. At wrestling, Rao had the edge, but Gaelren could still hold his own. Rao was another of God's blessings. They'd met in the service of Duke Robert, and despite their different natures, instantly taken to each other. The unlikely friendship had saved Gaelren's sanity, and probably his life. Born and raised in the balmy lands of southern France, Rao had taken the cross for adventure, not blessings. As far as Gaelren could tell, he'd found no spiritual meaning in visiting the land where Christ once walked. When they'd liberated Bethlehem, Rao had not knelt on the ground, but looked around at the small houses cluttered with poultry, goats, and grubby children, and remarked that he'd expected the Lord's birthplace to be somewhat grander. Having seen that Jerusalem too was just a city, Rao had been happy enough to return to Europe. It was clear, however, that his main purpose in returning so quickly was to take care of his friend. Perhaps out of guilt? At the end of the taking of Jerusalem, finally revolted by the slaughter, Gaelren had tried to defend a bunch of boys from a group of German knights. The children had been armed only with sticks and slingshots, but they'd been dangerous nevertheless, fighting with the same ferocity as their fathers. It was sensible to kill them, insane to get involved, but Gaelren had been ready to die there by their side. Rao had stopped him, knocking him senseless and dragging him away. It had taken days for him to get his wits back, so it wasn't surprising that Rao had been concerned. Sometimes Gaelren thought he'd not wanted to get his wits back and remember those children. Any ill effects of the blow had worn off long since. But Rao was being proved right about the lust. If the horses could go without rest, Gaelren would never stop. And he never ate without prompting. He shook his head
and instructed himself to be sensible. Getting lost in heated daydreams was more likely to delay his arrival than speed it. He tightened his horse's girth and checked the dun gelding. He'd not taken time to seek out ideal horses, but this one seemed to be fair enough. Satisfied, he mounted and pulled up his coif. Raoul rode over to his side, tawny hair still uncovered.
"Do you expect trouble here? There's been no sign of unrest."
Gowron shrugged and pushed the chain hood back again. "I suppose not, though King William does not keep an orderly realm, and we're close to the Scottish lands." Raoul scanned the area. Here by the river, trees softened the landscape, but to the west and north lay sweeping moorland, made sullen by the cloudy day.
"It's hard to imagine anyone wanting this place. You want me, my friend, but I didn't expect something quite so bleak. I gather it was somewhat less bleak before it was fought over in 68. Raoul grimaced. "I don't think fighting caused the climate."
Gowron laughed. "I suppose not. The sun does shine sometimes, I promise." He urged his horse up the slope to the road. "And you're right, we're safe enough. If the Scots were bold enough to raid hereabouts, my father and brothers would drive them back with their tails between their legs." Raoul joined him, and they went forward at a walk to ease the horses.
"Your father's castle is close by our road?"
"Yes."
"That's good. We can get a proper meal."
"Do you think of nothing but food?"
"Someone has to."
"Well, hungry or not, we ride by." Raoul stared at him.
"After 2 years abroad?"
"I can hardly stop. Gobble a hunk of beef and leave, can I? And I intend to be home today. I'll do the happy family reunion another time." After a moment, Raoul said,
"Have you thought that it might be a shock, you just showing up at your gate?"
Gowron looked sideways. "Oh, is that it? You want me to stop at Brome and send a polite message to warn Jahan to air the mattress?"
"It might be a no."
Raoul shrugged with a rattle of mail.
"So be it, but if your wife falls into a dead faint at your feet, don't blame me."
"Jahan never faints."
"The Lady Jahan has probably never had a husband turn up from nowhere before. You should have written from Bruges."
"What point, when a letter would travel no faster than I?"
"When did you last write? Would she have any idea to expect you?"
"Before Jerusalem." And Gowron kicked the darn up to speed before his startled friend could ask more questions. He'd written regularly on the way out, sending letters from Rome, Cyprus, and Antioch. After the horrors of Jerusalem, however, he'd not been able to write anything to anyone. He'd concentrated blindly on getting home. Without Raoul's help, he might not have made it. And in order to keep going, he had blocked out all thought except his goal. Heyward, Jahan, and his son. It hadn't occurred to him until now that, for Jahan, there would have been a silence of over a year. In a way, he'd expected her to know where he was and what he was doing without being told.
But Jahan wouldn't faint.
She hadn't fainted when told she had to marry him. She hadn't fainted when they'd been attacked by brigands and one of her attendants had died before her eyes. Those were probably the two most shocking events in her life.
Then he remembered the boar. But she hadn't fainted then either. They'd been in the woods, making love. Yes, making love. For in those early days, it had seemed to him that each joyous coupling
had added love to the world. Jahan had liked to make love in the open. She found the idea of someone interrupting them exciting rather than embarrassing. A bore, however, was rather more than either of them had counted on, and it came upon them at a miserable time. Jahan was on top, and Gowran was close to release. Then, she was gone, and when Gowran gathered together the scraps of his shattered mind, he found her straddled over him, his heavy sword in her small hands.
"Hell's flames, Gowran! Get your brain out of your cock and kill the beast! Or do I have to do it myself?"
There'd been many a time when he'd wished he'd said, "Go ahead," and watched her have to beg. She wouldn't have begged, though. Jahan never begged. She'd have tried. She might even have succeeded. Jahan was tall for a woman, which had not best pleased him as a youth. Though slender, she was strong. Of course she wouldn't have been able to kill a boar with a sword. That was a difficult feat for a skillful man. But she would have tried. Perhaps the boar knew it. Unusually for that animal, it had backed away and fled. Perhaps dismayed by the tall, white-skinned, pale-haired woman snarling at it, sword in hand. Gowran had dissolved into laughter, and the next he knew, Jahan was back, driving him into another, more wonderful dissolution. A form of dissolution he longed to experience once again. No, not just once. He urged his mount to greater speed, wondering if their marriage would be as if he had never left, or better. He knew he'd changed while away. He'd been 22 when he'd taken the cross, and had generally led a pleasant life. Now at 25 he was leaner, harder, and calloused on body and soul. He'd seen marvels to strengthen his faith, and horrors to sour it. Jahan must have changed too. Perhaps she would have plumped up after having a child. He'd always admired her slender elegance. But bigger breasts and a cozy armful might be good too. Jahan in any form would be good. Raoul was right. He should have sent warning from Bruges. He should stop and send warning today. He wouldn't, though. With an anticipatory grin, Gowran realized he wanted to surprise her. He wanted to catch his cool wife in her working clothes, skirt curtled up, her fine hair escaping its braids as it always did. He wanted her to look up and gape with shock, then flush with joy. Jahan didn't like to be caught unawares, so every now and then he liked to do it, like when he gave her the rose. He wasn't a man for giving fancy gifts, and up north, they didn't see many. But on a trip to York, he'd spotted the rose on a merchant stall, wonderfully carved out of ivory, each petal edge fine as a real one. It was an impractical thing, too small to decorate a room and too big for jewelry, but he'd bought it anyway, because its sharp-edged beauty made him think of Jahan. And after just a few days away, he missed her. When he'd given it to her, her cheeks had flushed, and her eyes had shone, perhaps even with a hint of tears. Jahan rarely cried. She'd cried, though, when she broke it. He smiled ruefully at the memory of her grief over the accident. Other losses had been met with fierce composure, but the rose, sent flying off its shelf in a careless moment, had melted her to tears. They'd stuck the broken petals back with wax, but one was chipped and another cracked, and it had never been as perfect as it was. Oh well, he'd brought her gifts from the Holy Land. Perhaps one of them would be the equal of the rose. He thought he might have some bed tricks too. That would catch her unawares. He'd kept his vow, But other men had explored the Eastern women and brought back stories. Jahan would be interested. She liked to experiment. And now that there was no anxiety about barrenness, she would be happy to play again. Tonight, Jahan. Jahan in bed, or on the bed, so he could feast on the sight of her. Pale blonde hair spilling loose over the mattress. Supple body, his again to touch, to taste, to finally, finally enter. Such thoughts were not wise. He was hard as a rock, bulging, throbbing, as if he might prove Raoul's words true and explode. He'd controlled lust and frustration for over 2 years, so he should be able to do so for a few more hours. But he had to adjust carefully in the saddle to find a tolerable position as he rode. He realized then that he was into familiar land at last, his own valley land, the strip fields rich with summer, the fells dotted with plump sheep. The sun was setting, and the dun was beginning to tire. But now was no time to stop. He kicked him on, galloping through familiar villages, scattering geese, chickens, and people. The cries of, "It's Lord Gaelran! Lord Gaelran!" fell quickly behind like the cries of the startled birds. Then he saw the square stone keep of Hayward Castle, beyond some trees, and reined in sharply. He'd dreamed of this so many times that it almost felt like another dream. He needed a moment to convince himself that it was finally, blessedly real. It looked no different. It was as if he'd ridden away yesterday. Raoul reined up beside him, his horse foaming with effort. "So, we made it, though your men are straggled out behind for a league. Do we wait for them to gather and ride down quietly, as if there had been no hurry at all?" The thought had crossed Gaelran's mind. Trust Raoul to read him so well. "No," he said, and kicked into a canter to ride around the curve of the road and into full view of his home. He hauled the dun to a rearing stop. An army seethed around Hayward. His castle was under siege. "By the five wounds? Who?" Raoul shaded his eyes from the flare of the setting sun. "The pennant shows red and green." Raoul's eyesight had always been remarkable, but Gaelran could scarcely believe it. "That's my father's pennant." "Then, your father is besieging your castle."
2. Gaelran couldn't deny Raoul's words. By now he, too, could make out the familiar banner of William of Brome, fixed by the handsome main tent. He even recognized the tent. It was his father's pride and joy. All joy dissolved into dread. He stared at Hayward, at the simple square keep, and at the solid curtain wall, newly completed, just before he left. They bore no marks. Hayward was one of the strongest castles in the north. Who had taken it without a battle? And what had happened to his wife and child? Ice on his heart, he surged down the slope into the camp, ignoring cries and attempts to bar his way. He was aware of the sword in his hand, only when he almost used it on a man. He halted the action just as the guard stopped his attack, shock on his face.
"My lord, Gaelran. It's Lord Gaelran. It's the Lord of Hayward,"
the words whispered about him strangely. Shocked, disbelieving, horrified. Then his father pushed through the crowd, still massive and ruddy-faced, but greyer than Gaelran remembered.
"Gaelran, is it you? Christ be praised, oh, we thought you dead."
A groom had run to hold Gaelran's bridle,
His father almost dragged him from the horse into a rib-crushing back-pounding.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?